Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Agatha Christie, A Mysterious Life by Laura Thompson, performed by Pearl Hewitt. The one thing people never forget is the unsolved. Nothing lasts like a mystery. From The Ebony Tower by John Fowles. The Villa at Torquay. Between the ages of 5 and 12 years old, I led a wonderfully happy life. From a letter written by Agatha Christie in 1973. I remembered another thing Robert saying, that there had been no bad fairies at Rupert St. Lou's christening. I had asked him afterwards what he meant, and he had replied, "Well, if there's not one bad fairy, where's your story?" From The Rose and the Yew Tree by Agatha Christie, writing as Mary Westmacott. It is a steep climb up Barton Road in Torquay, and at the top there is nothing to be seen. Here stood the house in which Agatha Christie was born. Now only imagination can bring it back to life. All her life, Agatha was in love with her own childhood, and her family home, Ashfield, was the arena of her childhood dreams. She continued to dream about the house all her life. When it was demolished in the 1960s, 20 years after it had been sold, perhaps as proof that she had finally grown up, she cried, like a child. Walking up the road, it is hard to grasp the past, because there is so little of it left. Barton Road is out of the town proper, but this has not protected it from modern England. Gimcrack college buildings, a wholesale and import warehouse, a school and a block of council flats now line the hill that led to Ashfield. A couple of bungalows now stand on the approximate site of Agatha's house. A path beside them leads to a secret triangle of earth bounded by a rocky wall. Might it once have been an edge of her garden? It is possible. Here in the cool dark corner around a tree stump may have been the dog cemetery, in which the family pets, including Tony the Yorkshire Terrier, Agatha's first dog, were buried beneath little headstones. So imagination works on this hidden piece of Torquay, and on the scratchy cry of seagulls, which would have been as familiar to Agatha as her own name, and on the unchanged shape of Barton Road, the sense of her walking up and down with the breeze in her hair and her ribs heaving joyfully. As a child, hand in hand with her nurse, later, laced into tight corsets and trailing a handsome skirt whose hem was thick with dirt. Oh, to climb that hill in a corset. It was here that her first husband, Archie Christie, came chugging on his motorbike in search of the cool, slim girl he had fallen for at a dance near Exeter. He sat and took tea with Agatha's mother and waited for her to trip home from across the road. She had been playing badminton at Rooklands, one of the handful of houses that stood like her own within its own relaxed grounds. That was her world then. Those were the years of Edwardian serenity. Summer followed summer in a long haze. Sloping lawns were shadowed with tea tables, with the arch of croquet hoops, with a soft droop of picture hats. The air smelled rose sweet, and happiness was an easy business. Agatha never lost the sense of those years. They always remained inside her. From the top of Barton Road, one looks down at Torquay, the rise and fall of its seven hills, the curved sweep of bay, with the sea gleaming beyond. This is the view, part revealing, part hidden, that Agatha would have known and loved, so well that when she travelled the world with Archie in the 1920s, she wrote back to her mother that South Africa was like all really beautiful places, just like Torquay. That place no longer exists. The Torquay of Agatha's youth was configurative, complete. An elegant land of its own, with its crescents and terraces, its huge pale villas shrouded amid trees and hills, its rituals and structures, and distant wildness. It was a watering place, gently restorative, the kind of town at which people arrived carrying letters of introduction. In summer, the local newspaper published weekly lists of the names of holiday visitors, and it was said that these read like the Almanach de Gotha. The resident families were of Agatha's own class, middle tending towards upper. This homogeneity was precious. Around her, all was protection and stasis. Within, therefore, her imagination could go free. Could it have conjured the Torquay of the 21st century? In the years after the war, Agatha had a respectful terror of social change, and in some ways, she was as much of a realist about life as her old lady detective, Miss Marple, who always expects the worst and is usually right to do so. But Agatha was also a woman of deep faith in God and human nature. Could she then have foreseen the gleeful rupture within England that would rip the heart from her birthplace? Torquay's handsome Fleet Walk, splashed with lurid shop fronts. The proud Strand, colonized by bare-chested inebriates. The 1851 Town Hall, now a branch of Tesco. The old bank, with its pale gold stone facade, now Bank's Cafe Bar. The elegant 1912 Seafront Pavilion, now a shopping mall. The palm trees shriveling outside Mambo Nightclub, the calm creamy villas advertising vacancies and Cantonese food, the junkies and asylum seekers lurching along High Union Street, where Agatha's father had bought china for Ashfield. Modernity blurring every proud shape, the change in England writ large here because Torquay is a place of pleasure, and pleasure is what now defines us. Agatha believed in pleasure too. She loved ease and respite and idleness. But she would have doubted Miss Marple's other creed that the new world was the same as the old, that human beings were the same as they had always been, when she saw the holidaymakers and their urgency for sensation, their burgers belched into the sun, and their bottles swung like lances. She had begun to doubt the future in one of her last books, Passenger to Frankfurt, which she wrote in her late 70s. What a world it was nowadays. Everything used the whole time to arouse emotion. Discipline, restraint, none of these things counted for anything anymore. Nothing mattered but to feel. What sort of a world could that make? It made the England of today. Bored, violent, decadent. It made a society with no sense of order, of cause and effect, of history. And Agatha had foreseen this, although she had not entirely believed that it would come to pass. Can this be England? Is England really like this? One feels, no, not yet. But it could be. In fact, Passenger to Frankfurt ends with an affirmation in hope, faith, and benevolence. So Agatha would have been shocked and grieved by the 21st century. She would have mourned the town in which she had dreamed, loved, run up hills with Tony the dog, lost her virginity to Archie Christie, become a writer. Above all, she would have been saddened by the new English joylessness, for life to her was a sacred gift. In Torquay, Agatha is everywhere, the shops, the museum, and yet she is nowhere. What she was, what made her, no longer exists. Only in flickering moments does one glimpse a girl in a white dress, skipping through shadowy sunlit streets, her head full of mysteries. No mystery greater than this one, that in an England apparently bent upon destroying everything she believed and embodied, Agatha Christie remains never more popular. The paradox would have intrigued her. Then she would have contemplated her dinner and her garden and retired to the world of her mind. That was where she lived throughout much of her childhood, in her imagination within Ashfield. The two were indissoluble. Every corner, every shadow of her home was magical to her. She loved it with a child's directness, but also with an adult depth, seeming to intuit the sadness in love, the knowledge of impermanence that makes happiness so intense. She had an allergic instinct. Unusually for a child, she had an overview. Even as she was steeped in their warm stillness, she sensed the ending of the eternal summers and turned every moment of them into instant memory. "There is no joy like joy in dreams," wrote the adult Agatha Christie, surely remembering how Ashfield had been hallowed by the visions that came to her in sleep. The dream fields at the bottom of the garden, the secret rooms inside her own home. Sometimes you got to them through the pantry. Sometimes, in the most unexpected way, they led out of Daddy's study. But there they were all the time, although you had forgotten them for so long. Each time, you had a delighted thrill of recognition. And yet, really, each time they were quite different. But there was always that curious secret joy about finding them. This is from Unfinished Portrait, published in 1934, one of the six novels she wrote under the name of Mary Westmacott. It is as close to her own story as the autobiography that was published posthumously. Many of the same childhood tales are told in both books, yet Unfinished Portrait feels closer to the truth of that time. It is written with a yearning quality, suffused with the love she felt for a past that had been wrenched from her 8 years earlier. The wounds still weep on the page. Agatha never lost the ability to experience the world through a child's eyes. "In a great many years' time, when you are still a child, as you always will be," wrote her second husband, Max Mallowan, in a letter of 1930. She retained both her memories and her direct sense of how those memories felt. Nothing was ever more alive to her. The first Westmacott, Giant's Bread, also 1930, has a boy, Vernon Dare, as its protagonist. But much of his early life is a replication of Agatha's. "A new nursemaid came, a thin white girl with protruding eyes. Her name was Isabel, but she was called Susan, as being more suitable. This puzzled Vernon very much. He asked Nurse for an explanation. There are people who, when they christen their children, set themselves up to ape their betters." The word ape had a distracting influence on Vernon. Apes were monkeys. Did people christen their children at the zoo? As Agatha did, Vernon has waking dreams, like this one, which flourished in the infinity of the garden at Ashfield. Mr. Green was like God, in that you couldn't see him, but to Vernon he was very real. The great thing about Mr. Green was that he played. He loved playing. Whatever game Vernon thought of, that was just the game that Mr. Green loved to play. There were other points about him. He had, for instance, 100 children, and 3 others. They were called by the 3 most beautiful names that Vernon knew: Poodle, Squirrel, and Tree. Vernon was, perhaps, a lonely little boy, but he never knew it, because, you see, he had Mr. Green and Poodle, Squirrel, and Tree to play with. Agatha never thought of herself as lonely. Such an idea would not have occurred to her. She treasured solitude and the space it gave her for other lives. She also treasured privacy. When she overheard her nurse discussing one of her earliest imaginary games with a housemaid, "Oh, she plays that she's a kitten with some other kittens," she was upset to the core. She had cast a delicate spell over her home. Secrecy preserved the magic, and a photograph of Agatha as a child shows a face full of secrets. A stubborn little fairy girl, seated on a wicker chair in her enchanted garden. "I was to know every tree in it and attach a special meaning to each tree." All her life, she saw Ashfield through those child's eyes. Her detective novel, The Hollow, describes a house, Ainswick, that represents vanished happiness to the characters in the book, and has a garden filled with Ashfield's trees. There was a magnolia that almost covered one window and which filled the room with a golden green light in the afternoons. Through the other window, you looked out onto the lawn, and a tall Wellingtonia stood up like a sentinel. And to the right was a big copper beech. Oh, Ainswick. Ainswick. What did Ashfield look like? A large villa, comfortable, not grand, with a fine lawn leading to a small wood. A family home. Photographs, pink-tinged and poignant, show it to have been a mass of harmonious accretions. Part two story, part three, it had several chimneys, generous windows that reached down to the garden, and a porch, shadowy with creeper. A conservatory, filled with palm trees, was a sultry hothouse in those days of heavy clothes. There was also a greenhouse, called, I don't know why, K.K., which housed a rocking horse named Matilde, and a small painted horse and cart named True Love. Agatha wrote about these in her last book, Postern of Fate, in which she lets the conventions of detective fiction slip away and walks, free as a ghost, into her past. As with all her late writing, the book was spoken into a dictaphone. Her voice, in a brief recording, is cracked and vibrant with memory. Matilde is described as looking forlorn and forsaken, with her mane fallen out and one ear broken. But when a character in the book jumps on her back, she races back and forward in the same old way. Got action, hasn't it? Yes, it's got action. A few years before she wrote Postern of Fate, Agatha received a letter from an old Torquay friend. Our gardens, yours and mine, were magical places. How sad that Barton Road is so changed and that houses have been built over Ashfield. And yet, for all its charm, Ashfield did not compare with the home that Agatha would later make her own in Devon. The white Georgian perfection of Greenway, set like a pale jewel above the River Dart, was as magical in truth as the dream house that she had made of Ashfield. And for all that the child Agatha loved her home, she was always looking beyond its limits. I wanted, she wrote in her autobiography, above everything in the world, to be the Lady Agatha one day. Within this lay a desire not to do with snobbery, to inhabit the numinous place that hovered at the edges of her imagination. Something you want so much that you don't quite know what it is, she wrote of the perfect house in one of her last novels, Endless Night. The thing that mattered most to me. Funny that a house could mean that. In Giant's Bread, the young boy does not live at Ashfield. He is heir to a house called Abbot's Puissant, which is of ineffable ancient beauty. In another of the Westmacotts, The Rose and the Yew Tree, the heroine Isabella is as one with her home, St. Lou Castle. Medieval, severe, and austere. Agatha longed to walk through a world of that kind and call it her own. With Greenway, she would do so in a sense, but not the Isabella sense. She was at once too middle class and too much of a thinker. The very mind that could dream up a St. Lou Castle would prevent her always from losing herself in its reality. No doubt her inner life would have developed less freely had she been born into a different kind of family. Perhaps it would not have existed at all. But the Millers of Torquay were not as conventional as their appearance suggested, and the dynamic of the family left Agatha protected yet separate, which was ideal for the growth of her particular personality. Agatha Mary Clarissa was the last of three children, born on the 15th of September 1890, 11 years after her sister Margaret, Madge, and 10 after her brother Louis Montant, Monty. Her father, Frederick, was far too much the gentleman to interfere in his children's inner lives. Clarissa, her mother, whose inquisitiveness would have been far greater, had the instinctive wisdom of knowing just how much of this interest to show. Clara, as she was known, was like the nurse who attends Vernon in Giant's Bread, to whom he was able to speak of poodle, squirrel, and tree, and of Mr. Green and the 100 children. And instead of saying, "What a funny game," Nurse Frances merely inquired whether the 100 children were girls or boys. Clara was, in fact, an original. Her influence upon Agatha, both by omission and involvement, was almost absolute. A distinguished-looking little person, with the near black eyes of a clever bird, she was the centre of the Ashfield world, the person who made imagination both possible and safe. She was also probably the love of Agatha's life. Written 8 years after Clara's death, Unfinished Portrait is a testament to that love. A hymn of desperate loss. Agatha spares herself nothing in the book. "Oh, Mummy, Mummy," she writes, missing the mother who is on holiday abroad. And the pathos of 8-year-old Celia is also that of Agatha in her 40s, longing still for Clara. In the evening, after Susan had given Celia, Agatha's fictional self, her bath, Mummy would come into the nursery to give Celia a last tuck. Mummy's tuck, Celia would call it. And she would try to lie very still so that Mummy's tuck would still be there in the morning. Clara's understanding of her daughter, the queer, luminous, searching look that she would bend upon her, is almost total, certainly in Agatha's eyes. This is shown by a story also told in the autobiography of an episode in France in 1896, when Agatha was on an expedition with her father. A guide, thinking to please her, had pinned a live butterfly to her straw hat. Celia was miserable. She could feel the wings of the butterfly fluttering against her hat. It was alive, alive, skewered on a pin. She felt sick and miserable. Large tears gathered in her eyes and rolled down her cheeks. At last her father noticed. "What's the matter, Poppet?" Celia shook her head. Her sobs increased. How could she say what was the matter? It would hurt the guide's feelings terribly. He had meant to be kind. He had caught the butterfly specially for her. He had been so proud of his idea in pinning it to her hat. How could she say out loud that she didn't like it? And nobody would ever, ever understand. The wind made the butterfly's wings flap more than ever. Mummy would understand, but she couldn't tell Mummy. They were all looking at her, waiting for her to speak. A terrible agony welled up in her breast. She gazed dumbly, agonizingly, at her mother. "Help me," that gaze said. "Oh, do help me." Miriam, Clara, gazed back at her. "I believe she doesn't like that butterfly in her hat," she said. "Who pinned it there?" Clara, too, had a wildly vital inner life. But hers, unlike Agatha's, was born of insecurity rather than protection. She was born in 1854 to a glamorous army captain, Frederick Beamer, who at the age of 36 had fallen for a beautiful girl of not quite 17, Mary Ann West. After 12 years of marriage and 4 children, Captain Beamer, then stationed in Jersey, was killed in a fall from his horse, leaving Mary Ann a young and impoverished widow. At almost exactly the same time, Mary Ann's older sister Margaret made a less romantic, more lucrative marriage to an American widower much older than herself, named Nathaniel Frary Miller. Mary Ann was in dire straits. Margaret immediately offered to take one of the 4 children off her sister's hands. Clara, the only girl, then aged 9, was handed over. Agatha was fascinated by the story of these West sisters, orphan girls who were taken in by relations, the Kelseys, in the early 19th century, and raised on their farm in Sussex. As a child, she was told lots of tales about her ancestry. She loved to hear about the Kelseys of Primstead Farm and the rich Crowder cousins, of whom the Wests were jealous, as they always had real lace on their drawers. Particularly alive to her was the story of Mary Ann and Captain Frederick. Perhaps because it had become for her a poignant ideal of faithful romance, she wrote her own version of it to her second husband, Max Mallowan, in a letter of 1944. My grandmother was married at 16.
They say you're too young to marry me, Polly.
I'll run away with you tomorrow if they won't let me marry you. To a handsome army officer, 20 years older than she was. She was exceptionally lovely. People stopped to stare after her in the street. She was left with hardly any money and had to do fine embroidery and sewing to support and educate her children. At least 3 of her husband's brother officers wanted to marry her, 2 of them well-off men. Economically, it would have been desirable, but she refused everybody, certainly never had a lover, and, up to the age of 70, steadfastly declared it was her wish her body should be taken to Jersey when she died and buried with her husband there. In fact, her 3 sons, Harry, Ernest, and Frederick, prevailed in their wish for Mary Ann to be buried in England, so that they could visit her grave. What her daughter thought on the subject is not known. It is a modern freedom to criticize one's parents, and it would not have occurred to Clara, in some ways very typical of her era, to shun the mother who had given her away. She was a buttoned-up little girl, solitary like Agatha, but lonely with it, wandering through her sickly uncle's house, clasping a copy of her favourite book, King of the Golden River. She had suffered a good deal being sent away, yet her behaviour towards Mary Ann was always utterly correct. In her 20s she wrote a poem, To Mother, full of irreproachable sentiment. Love is the angel who guards the path to heaven. It could have been written to anybody, though. The poem for her Aunt Margaret is a little more personal and dutifully praises a character of worth, beloved by all around. Agatha writes in her autobiography that Mary Ann could scarcely be blamed for what she did, that she probably gave Clara away because she thought a girl needed help in life, while boys could make their own luck. Yet Clara always believed that her mother simply loved her less. She was too sensitive to withstand the rejection. I think the resentment she felt, the deep hurt at being unwanted, coloured her attitude to life. It made her distrustful of herself and suspicious of people's affection. Her aunt was a kindly woman, good-humoured and generous, but she was imperceptive of a child's feelings. My mother had all the so-called advantages of a comfortable home and a good education. What she lost and what nothing could replace was the carefree life with her brothers, in her own home. This is a recurring theme in Agatha's writing, the need for children to be brought up in their own surroundings, the damage that is done to them when they are given away, or, as in Ordeal by Innocence, sold for £100. The humiliation, the pain, he'd never got over it. It lies at the heart of The Mirror Cracked from Side to Side and The Mousetrap. It is touched on elsewhere, and it is always treated with the same seriousness. It was Agatha's nature to feel Clara's emotions as if they were her own. Indeed, such was her love for her mother, she may have experienced greater agony than Clara herself ever did. When, many years later, she wrote this speech for a female character in Mrs. McGinty's Dead. There was a woman writing in the paper the other day, a really stupid letter, asking what was best to do, to let your child be adopted by someone who could give it every advantage, or whether to keep it when you couldn't give it advantages of any kind. I think that's stupid, really stupid. If you can just give a child enough to eat, that's all that matters. I ought to know. My mother parted with me, and I had every advantage, as they call it. And it's always hurt, always, always, to know that you weren't really wanted, that your mother could let you go. I wouldn't part with my children, not for all the advantages in the world. These are Agatha's thoughts, of course,
and they would never have been voiced in this way by Clara. But there is no doubt that Clara's childhood experience affected her, in particular, her relationship with her daughters. It also played its part in her marriage. Margaret and her husband had no children of their own, but Nathaniel, from his first marriage, had a son named Frederick. He was 8 years Clara's senior and a real New Yorker, albeit with a Swiss education, a Frenchman's worldliness, an English sense of protocol, and an entree into the wildly select Union Club. He was an American straight out of the Age of Innocence, that is to say, one who aspired to sacred Europeanism. But he was an American all the same, and had something free within, an openness, a ribaldry, a refusal to take himself seriously, that was not of the Victorian world. Agatha was proud of her American blood, and, as an old woman on a visit to New York, was adamant that she would visit the Brooklyn graves of her Miller relations, even though she had never met them. She, too, would prove to have a more open spirit than Torquay might have allowed. There was fresh air in her blood as well as her lungs. The Miller fortune had been made in America, but it had interests in Manchester. So after their marriage, Nathaniel and Margaret settled in Cheshire, where Frederick, a fond son, would visit them, trailing a haze of cosmopolitanism and frankly dazzling the sad little Clara. That she should have married him in 1878 is a fairy story, a romance to rival that of Mary Ann Beamer, except that there is a very faint air of patronage about the way in which Frederick abandoned his gay flirtations, with Winston Churchill's mother among others, and proposed to his dear faithful cousin, whose soul he had set on fire years earlier, with his careless praise for her lovely eyes. Shades of Sonia in Uncle Vanya? When a girl is plain, everybody says, "You have lovely hair, you have lovely eyes." Clara was not a beauty. Indeed, she turned down Frederick's first proposal because she felt herself to be dumpy. But she had a remarkable character, far more powerful than that of her charming husband. And this, in the end, would redress the imbalances in their marriage. During her engagement, though, she wrote poems to F.A.M., Frederick Alva Miller, which show her brimful of passionate, anxious gratitude. "God in heaven, listen to me. Listen to my whispered prayer. Make me worthy, though so lowly, all his love and life to share." There is also an odd, frequently struck note of fear. "Keep him safe from every evil and temptation's treacherous power." Clearly she was aware of her husband's rakish past. "He quickly loved, O face and flower, with careless, listless will." And alert to the possibilities of repeat performances. Her poems, written in a conscientious hand, in an album bought at Whiteley's, return continually to the apprehension of betrayal. "O God, was it only a fancy, that dream of my maiden life? Is this the once wonderful hero who won me for his wife?" In fact, there is no reason to think that Frederick, who made occasional little changes to the poems, so knew perfectly well their serious substance, was anything but a faithful husband. But the loss of certainty as a child had prepared Clara to expect the worst. In this, she was utterly unlike Agatha, the happiness of whose early life prepared her for nothing. Some people are wise. They never expect to be happy. I did, she wrote later, in The Hollow. A good deal of her childhood happiness came from Agatha's sense that her parents' marriage was serene and stable. Yet Unfinished Portrait, as always, understands more about the realities than she knew at the time. It isn't always wise to care too much. "It's a thorn in your side always," says Miriam to her daughter. And later, "Don't ever leave your husband too long alone, Celia. Remember, a man forgets." "Father would never have looked at anyone but you," her mother answered musingly. "No, perhaps he wouldn't, but I was always on the lookout." there was a parlour maid, a big, handsome girl, the type I had often heard your father admire. She was handing him the hammer and some nails. As she did it, she put her hand over his. I saw her. Your father hardly noticed. He just looked surprised. But I sent that girl away. At once. Frederick, meanwhile, had all the unassailable self-confidence of his class, which was subtly above that of Clara. The girl in Mrs. McGinty's Dead is also enabled, by her adoption, to marry a gentleman. He was no oil painting. Photographs show him to have been a fat, bearded man looking years older than his real age, with the heavy, sleepy eyes inherited by Agatha. But he seems to have been liked by everybody who knew him. In her autobiography, Agatha writes of the happy atmosphere at Ashfield, that it was largely due to my father. He spent his life doing nothing. As a young man, he was a socialite. In middle age, a gentleman of leisure. He never was in business, having inherited a very comfortable fortune from his father. Read a testimonial sent from the Union Club to the American ambassador when Agatha was 18, about to come out in society. That I can vouch for him in the highest terms is putting it mildly, and it would seem as if the daughter, Miss Agatha Miller, was in every way entitled to be presented. For all that she worshipped her quick, clever mother, Agatha had an irresistible admiration for Frederick's easy charm. His was the class to which she already felt herself to belong, although in adulthood she had neither his social manner nor his gift for indolence. "But I cannot see what is morally right about working," she pronounced in an interview in 1964. "My father was a gentleman of substance, and never did a hand's turn in his life, and he was a most agreeable man." He was also a fool, although not intellectually stupid by any means. He knew exactly the worth of the people around him, but it was not in his nature to present to them anything other than his agreeable front. No doubt to show willing to his family, he produced a couple of short stories. These had something of his daughter's instinctive insight into human nature. They also proved him a far better writer than Clara. Her bedtime tales danced with invention. Agatha was both frustrated and entranced by the way Clara would be unable to return to a story on the following night, so simply made up a new one. But her laboured writing drowned ever more deeply in Victorian convention. "So I was dead. This, then, must be my spirit, which had consciousness." Frederick's story, entitled Henry's Engagement, is a variation on his own courtship of Clara. Henry, a womanizing dandy, is worshipped by Marian, who is religious and high-principled, and, like Clara, has absolutely no sense of humor. Henry was very much in love, but with characteristic indolence displayed no unseemly haste in putting the momentous question. After all, there was really no hurry. Frederick waited until he was 32 before he abandoned his gay dog life and proposed. Henry never does marry Marian, instead telling her that he has fallen for another girl whose tiny hands excited Henry's admiration. Marian's were well formed, but large. Hearing this, Marian nobly renounces him. She had behaved splendidly. He would always think of her as one of the sweetest women he had ever met. The phrase pleased him. Frederick was kind, where Henry is cold. But the story hints at the same undercurrents that run through Clara's poetry. Beneath her liveliness, there was always anxiety inside Clara. She burned with the passionate piety of a nun painted by Holman Hunt. Frederick took life lightly, merrily. Another story, Why Jenkins Gave a Dinner, is set in the kind of New York club that was his natural habitat. The toast, "The ladies, God bless them," was drunk for the 27th time. It was Frederick's own charm, and it also shows a certain self-knowledge. Jimmy spent every bit of his yearly income and a little over with a sublime disregard for the future. He was greatly liked by his club associates. It is true that one of his best girls had said that it was a pity that he had more money than brains. When this was repeated to Jimmy by some kind friends, as of course it was, that youth remarked with great good humour that the lady was perfectly right, and immediately went out and sent her a costly bunch of cut roses. Although hardly a heroic character, Jimmy was an affable and lovable one. Like Jimmy, Frederick would squander his inheritance. He did so more through laziness than willful profligacy. Perhaps if he had returned to America with Clara, as he had intended to do after their marriage, he would have had an eye on the mismanagement of his New York investments and properties. But that was not how things happened. Instead, after a long honeymoon in Switzerland, the newlywed Millers came to stay at the fashionable resort of Torquay, where Madge was born in January 1879. Monty followed in June 1880 on a subsequent visit to New York. Then Clara returned to England while Frederick attended to business matters. When he rejoined her at Torquay for a year or so, as he thought, he discovered that she had bought Ashfield with the £2,000 left her by her uncle Nathaniel. It was a better use of the Miller fortune than Frederick ever made. It was also a bold, independent action that turned Clara, at a stroke, from supplicant into equal partner. Frederick had sown his wild oats in New York. In only his mid-thirties, he settled comfortably into middle age. In this, he was much encouraged by Torquay. During the Victorian era, it was an even more refined place than it would become in Agatha's youth. There was as yet no mixed bathing, no princess gardens in which to stroll, no pavilion in which to hear concerts. It was a town full of the well-behaved rich and well-to-do invalids. Napoleon III had restored his health while staying at the Imperial Hotel. Elizabeth Barrett Browning had taken the waters at the bathhouse on Victoria Parade. To some, it was overpoweringly genteel. "Torquay is such a place as I do desire to upset by dancing through it with nothing on but my spectacles," wrote Rudyard Kipling, not known for his bohemianism. Villas, clipped hedges, fat old ladies with respirators, and obese landaus. But all of this suited Frederick perfectly well. He had his family home and children, whom he adored in a frank, un-Victorian manner. "God bless you, my little darling," he wrote to Agatha from New York in 1896. "I know you are a dear, good girl." Beyond that, his life consisted of large meals, walks to the Royal Torbay Yacht Club, and shopping. A thick sheaf of bills shows the ease with which he spent what he believed to be a limitless income. As one now knows that the money was draining away, the exquisitely written bills have a queasy look. One pictures Frederick, perfectly dressed and shaved, smiling his way along the streets every morning to the club, unable to resist the lure of Donahue's or the fine art repository on Victoria Parade. When in London, he spent with similar abandon. There are many bills for the jewellery shops of West One, including one for £810. He also bought good furniture, 5 mahogany Chippendale chairs in Union Street, and rather less good paintings. Clusters of oils jostled upon the walls at Ashfield, although the rooms themselves were airy and elegant. A local artist, N.J.H. Baird, was commissioned to paint Frederick, the three children, Monty's dog, and Agatha's nurse. These pictures still hang at Greenway House. They have no great merit. "All of you look as if you hadn't washed for weeks," was Clara's judgment. But then, of course, her own portrait had not been painted. Although the picture of Nursey, as she was called, has a soft Flemish warmth. "A really lovely painting, I think," wrote Agatha in 1967, in reply to a woman who was cataloguing Baird's pictures. "My father always thought very highly of Baird's work." So Frederick ambled through life, leisurely and largo, a regal, talky personage with his Saxe Coburg appearance and unshakable bonhomie. He and Clara entertained friends frequently to sumptuous dinners. He was involved in charitable amateur dramatic performances, had a most cordial reception, according to a local newspaper, in his role as Felix Fumer in The Laughing Hyena, and acted as official scorer for the cricket club, whose ground was beyond Ashfield on Barton Road. In 1943, Agatha received a letter that began, "When 10 years of age, my parents lived near the Torquay Cricket Club ground, and to me there was, nor could be, any place on earth like it. I venerate its memory. How well I remember Mr. Miller. His likeness, at least I thought so, to King Edward. In a feudal and impressive way, he used to stroll onto the ground. I can see it all now as I lay on the slightly rising ground near the scoreboard with the fine red, white, and black flag flying from its crest." Agatha would have remembered this too. She often accompanied Frederick to the cricket. "I was extremely proud of being allowed to help my father with the scoring, and took it very seriously." She also learned mathematics with him, which she loved. "I think there's something heavenly about numbers," says a character in The Moving Finger. And these lessons were about as close as she came to formal education. Having sent Madge to the school in Brighton that would later become Rodin, Monty was at Harrow, Clara had the idea that Agatha should not go to school and should not learn to read until she was 8. So much for that. By the age of 4, Agatha had taught herself. "I'm afraid Miss Agatha can read, ma'am," Nursey explained apologetically to Clara. There is no telling why Clara came up with this theory. Her decisions could seem arbitrary, although more often than not they were proved right, as when she bought Ashfield, or when, in later years, she warned Agatha against marrying her first husband Archie. She knew human nature, which made her wise. Yet she was also said to have the inexplicable instinct of a sensitive. As a child, she dreamed that Primstead Farm had burned down. Soon afterwards, it did. And this sometimes made her silly. It was an absurd whim to try to stop an intelligent child reading, particularly in a house like Ashfield, which was crammed with books. Among Frederick's bills are several for Andrew Iredale, bookseller of Fleet Street, from whom he bought, among much else, 47 volumes of the Cornhill Magazine for £4, still in the library at Greenway, the complete works of George Eliot for £5, and French classics at 12 shillings apiece. It was unthinkable that Agatha would remain shut out of that world. Such was her determination that she worked out the words of a children's book called The Angel of Love by Mrs. L. T. Mead, vulgar, according to Clara, which had been read to her so often that she could match sounds to pages. From then on, she read anything and everything. Mrs. Molesworth, Edith Nesbit, Frances Hodgson Burnett, Old Testament stories, great events of history, her beloved Dickens, and later the Balzacs and Zolas that served, in Clara's view, as worldly education. Although the young Agatha was too innocent to see real life in literature, to her, books were their own reality.